Hello and welcome to PodCatalyst. I'm Peter Finn, Executive Director of IBC, or the International Association of Business Communicators. And for this episode, I got a chance to speak with Ed Cook. Ed is the co-founder of the Change Decision LLC, a change and culture consultancy focused on growing joy at work. The Change Decision seeks to make teams more effective by blending the science of decision analysis with the art of change management. Ed holds a PhD in systems modeling and analysis, focused on applying game theory and network analysis to decision-making. He employs his analytics expertise as a visiting professor at the University of Richmond's MBA and undergraduate program. Ed also served in the Navy and Navy Reserves. During this time in the Reserves, he worked extensively on employment initiatives for the people of Iraq, bridging across the U.S. military, the U.S. Embassy, and the government of Iraq. Ed's efforts helped create microloans to start new businesses, and training to improve job skills. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his efforts. Upon returning to the States and prior to co-founding the Change Decision, Ed worked the next few years to implement large process and infrastructure changes for a major U.S. bank, which Ed and I talked a little bit about during the interview. Ed, I should also point out, was a Navy pilot. Really fascinating background, and I think you'll enjoy the interview. Ed, thanks so much for taking some time to speak with me. You know, just to kind of kick things off, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, what led you to focus on a career of change management?
Yeah, sure, Peter, happy to. My exposure actually to change management happened later in my career. It was really more mid-career, what I refer to as my second career. So my first career was as a Navy pilot. So I used to fly jets off aircraft carriers and then moved from that into the business world. And pretty well into my career I was in a big Fortune 200 financial services institution working on a project, and things were having some difficulties. And I got my first connection to somebody who was working on change management. So it wasn't me. It was somebody who ended up being a colleague on my team to be part of our work to go do change management. I didn't even know what it was, really. I had the general idea, but never really thought of it as a profession with a series of processes or any of that kind of thing. And she really introduced me to that. And we were able to make a shift within this particular effort that was pretty significant. And that sort of opened my eyes to, hey, what was going on with this whole thing? And so from there, soon after, I took over a very large program and made sure to embed change management as part of it. There's a longer story that goes after that about how I decided to jump into my third career, which is to be a consultant that wraps decision-making and change management together. And it all led from that series of events that occurred now 12 years ago. So that's how I landed into change management in the first place.
Yeah, I was looking at your bio a little bit too. I mean, in addition to being, you know, a Navy pilot, which is incredibly impressive, it looks like you continue to do a lot of work in statistics and more of the quantitative side. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I got my PhD along the way in a pretty quant heavy area, but wrapped around the notion of decision making. And I'm a visiting professor at the University of Richmond. So I teach analytics and statistics classes in both the MBA and the undergraduate programs in the business school. And a little bit of machine learning and some higher level things as well that are wrapped around that, but mostly the core analytics. And so I try and bring that into the practice of change, because it can occur to many people as something that's pretty soft and squishy, and how do we even know if this is going right? And instead, been able to apply this analytic approach to really know whether or not we're making any progress in the change. And that is a key. It was key for me years ago when I was a leader of a project and trying to understand, are we making that sort of progress? And has been key now as a consultant to be able to help others who are driving change within their organization to really understand, are the efforts that they're taking, the tools and tactics that they're using, do they have any sort of an impact? Is it useful or not?
And I know where your current business is the change decision, correct?
And correct.
And I saw that, you know, your company philosophy has been to bring joy at work. And I think it's even in the title of your president and joy at work. But, you know, that might not be something that always, you know, people always think, you know, is sort of synonymous with change is joy. So, I was curious, you know, just, you know, how do you equate change to joy. And that's your philosophy and approach and what you do with your colleagues.
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at change and think about it negatively, right? At best, maybe it's something to get through, or we survived it, or thank goodness that's over. It has that sort of a feel for many people. We're trying to take the opposite approach with how I think about it with the consulting. And it's related back to an experience that I had years ago, which I'm happy to talk about. But let me just tell you what it is to start with. So most people have experienced going through some sort of a big effort or a project, and it was very difficult. And you may have accomplished every single business goal, hit every single thing that you wanted to do. And in all outward respects, it would seem like it was a success. But people look at that and they talk about being bruised and broken and how difficult it was, and they're exhausted by the entire event. I would look at that and say, well, the culture has been diminished. Joy at work has been reduced. And so when it comes back around for the next change effort that comes along, which is probably pretty soon, people are just worn out and they don't have the energy to step into that next thing. And it's because of how that change was happening. It's not what is changing. It's how the change has happened. People get that organizations have to change. And there's not a lot of people that I encounter that say we should never change. But how that change occurs, that is very important. And so hopefully you and others have had the opposite experience, which is you're working on something and maybe you didn't actually get even all of the business goals because you strive for something that was so difficult to do. But you did some good work. And you look back at that and feel energized by it. Like the culture has been lifted. And I would say the joy at work has been increased. And that's because of how it was done. How people handled that change actually brought the culture up. And so now as you come back around and you're thinking about the next change, people are energized by it. Like they're ready to step in and go do it. They have this sort of forward momentum that's about growing joy at work because of how that change occurred, how they interacted with everyone else around them. And to see that flip at an organization is just a wonderful thing to be part of, because the whole place changes just in terms of its energy and lightness, not just the project stuff, but just how people are acting within the organization itself. And that's powerful. And because change, I think, can be this really powerful thing both ways, right? It could crush the morale of an organization, but we can see it lifted up as well. And so that's why the work that we do at the Change Decision, we talk about growing joy at work and doing that with how people make decisions and how people drive change.
And are there some examples that come to mind that you think of where sort of the kind of the best couple of examples of that and how sort of able to achieve that and avoid some of the fatigue?
Sure. I'll give you what we refer to as our founding example. So this is before the Change Decision was even a glimmer in our eye. We're still in Fortune 200 land, and I was leading this very big technology process and policy change effort. And this is at a financial services institution, a bank, and we were changing out the teller system. So what did the tellers actually look like? And then all of the systems that go back behind that, all the way back to the core banking system. And then with that, all the processes that change. And so, that's about 10,000 people within the bank are being impacted, have to learn how to do their job differently. And this is a very long effort that about 18 months in is going very badly. And so badly that it was a $30 million effort that became a $70 million effort. So I had the awesome experience of getting to go tell the CIO that it was going to cost $40 million more than he thought it was going to cost. And that was not a fun conversation. And I'm sure the only reason I didn't get fired is because I wasn't the person that came up with the original $30 million. I'm just the guy delivering the bad news of here's where we are. But the very lowest point of all of that came at a company-wide meeting. In this particular place, the CEO would get everyone together once a year, kind of go over the strategy of what's going on with the company. And it was an all-day event. And at one point, a slide comes up and there's four boxes on the slide. And they represent the four biggest programs that are going on in the company, four biggest efforts. And he goes through the first three and talks about how great they are and how much we're learning and how wonderful all that has been. And then comes to the fourth one, which is the one that I'm leading. And he said, but there's just this one program that we're disappointed in. And it felt like 3,000 heads snapped around to look at me and see what my reaction was going to be to this thing, because the CEO just said that the thing that I'm working on is a disappointment. And I would really love to be able to tell you this hero story about how I dug deep and I reached deep inside myself and found the fortitude to move forward. But instead, what I did is I started working on my resume, because I thought for sure, if the CEO is going to say you're a disappointment in front of essentially the entire company and certainly all my peers and my boss, that I was not long for the company. But fortunately for me, Roxanne Brown, who's now my partner in the change decision, who was working with me, and she was the change management lead at the time, suggested that we do something different. And that difference was really rooted in joy at work. So how could we change the attitude and change the culture of just the team that we were on and use that as a way to just change what we are doing, try and not pay attention to all the external pressures and worry first about the team and then see how that would radiate outward. And it was dramatic almost from the very beginning. So she started with an interview process of, what does joy at work mean to me? Like, if I was experiencing that within the team, what would that be like? And then interviewed my leadership team to get it from them. And then she showed them what I said. And they all had a very similar reaction. They were surprised that it matched what they wanted, and then disappointed that that's not what was going on right now within the program. And it is what they wanted. And so the very next leadership meeting that I have, which was I would do every Friday, and in this particular company, they would literally phone it in. Right. So this is way before we did all this video stuff. Right. So people would be Friday afternoon, they would be at home and they would phone in to the meeting. And in this particular case, I'm running into the meeting because I'm thinking about I got to get on that 800 number and get everyone dialed in. And I'm expecting there to be, you know, me and maybe Roxanne and another person or two in the room. And I roll in and everyone is in the room and all the laptops are closed, which was super countercultural for this company. Everybody would always have their laptops up and they'd be mashing away on the keys all through every meeting. And they were doing that because they all wanted to see what was going to be different, that they had heard something different than they had ever heard before, that we're going to try and lead this thing differently and use change to help drive the culture, joy at work. And so just to speed the story up, that we finished 18 months later, although it wasn't the CEO of the company, it was the president of the bank, was standing in front of everybody talking about what an immense success we were. We were achieving employee satisfaction scores that were in like the 94-95% range. And this is in a company where the average is like 72%. And we were doing that through this immensely difficult thing to go do. It never got easier. So it was the project itself really never improved. It was just as hard as it was when the CEO was calling us out. But the attitude was very different. So I was on the phone 5 p.m. every single day talking to the software vendor about what they were going to do about all the defects. We had people that were staying up until 2 in the morning to actually land the systems into the branches, many of them knowing that they wouldn't even have jobs at the end of this because the program had gone on so long that job would go away. But even with all that, we still had these morale scores that were much higher than the rest of the company. And that was really the beginning of this idea that joy at work was a thing. You know, and in the years since then, I've done academic research on it, which relates back to my job at the University of Richmond. So actually researching what does joy at work mean, and put together 10 dimensions around joy at work to try and describe what that is and measure those. But then how do we actually do that, implement it as a thing that somebody can do on a little tiny 3-person team, or you can do on a gigantic 3,000-person team. It doesn't matter. How do we come up with the ways to help make that happen? So that's probably a longish answer.
No, it's really, really interesting. I mean, I guess what I was thinking is, you know, what were some of the like specific kind of levers, or, you know, the things? So it sounds like there were some interviews and, you know, just getting folks to talk about their experience and better understanding some of that. But I mean, what were some of the drivers, you know, because, you know, as you said, the work, it's not as if the work got any easier, but what were some of the things that kind of changed the, you know, I guess the attitude of folks?
Yeah, I think the very beginning of that, now use this phrase, setting the leader's intention.
Yeah.
So we were super clear about that. I think about that for people in the communication business as well. Like, how are we clear about what it is that we're trying to do? What is a leader's intention for this? And which I find fascinating about that is, if I go all the way back to my military career, we used to talk about the commander's intent. That was a phrase that was used. And it's exactly the same thing. In business, what is a leader's intent? So what does good look like? What are we actually trying to do here? And then how do we want to go make that happen? So in this particular case, what also ended up being different was rethinking almost everything that we did from the point of view of what is the impact going to be either on the program team that was doing it or on all these folks in the branches that were going to be on the receiving end of the work that we were doing. And then thirdly, even the customers that were going to be have an impact on it. And we actually ended up with some very surprising positive impacts there. But to go back to the program team, to give another example, I'm sure everybody listening to this that's at a company of any size is used to having some sort of an all hands, get everybody together group meeting. And I'm going to make the big giant leap and say that most of the people listening to this, their experience of that is that those things are boring and tedious and painful. As much as I'm sure people who are communicators that are trying to connect to that and do a good job, the structure that we put for by itself is not very interesting. And so that was one of the things like, okay, well, if we're literally going to fly people in from all over the country, which is what we were doing, why would we subject them to multiple hours of PowerPoint slides? You could literally record somebody talking about those and we could send the recordings out and save all the money of having to fly all those people in. So what could we do that would be different? This is, again, the how part. How could we have the interaction happen within the meeting so that it would be worthwhile to bring everybody in? So we did all sorts of things. I'll just highlight a couple examples for you. Instead of doing the regular sort of multiple, bring executives up, have them talk about things, all hands meeting, we structured the entire thing as a late night talk show. So we set the stage up like a late night talk show. I put on a suit. I sat the executives down and I would interview them. We had a band. So there was a whole bunch of people within the group who were musicians. We had people within the program team who sang, and we ran it like that, including we had the quality assurance guy, who was pretty funny, was my sidekick. So he basically sat on a stool behind me, just would make quips about whatever was going on with the executives. It was immensely popular, not just for the team. I mean, all these crusty, grumpy executives thought, how great was it to be able to walk out and interact that way? We did, instead of a regular Q&A, like had the people ask questions of the executives, we did reverse Q&A. So we had the executives ask questions of the program team that was in the audience. So we fed them some questions. Hey, ask Tom about all the successes that he and his team are having in doing this and prep them for it. And it was a way to communicate information about what's going on in the program so people got smarter about what was happening. It was also a way to highlight successes in the program. And it was a way for people to feel that these executives, who often can seem removed, actually know what's going on with the work that I'm doing. Like, my work matters and they actually know what's happening with it. And it was an immense change to how people thought about it. We do the typical survey afterwards, but we changed the survey question. So the top survey question was, this is the best all hands meeting I have ever underlined been to. And we got 60% of the people tick that box. And then the next one was, this was one of the best all hands meetings I've ever been to. And 35% of the people tick that box. And then two people said it was, you know, fine, which of course I obsessed on the two people and not the couple hundred people that did other stuff. But that's more my issue than it is about the success that we were able to have with that. But it was because we just kind of opened it up, and everything that we did, we were trying to rethink how could we go about doing it such that it would drive the culture. And as a result of that, my job became significantly easier. So it was incredibly stressful first 18 months for me, probably the most stressful that I've had in the business world. And it flipped from that to being very busy, but not stressful. Like, I wasn't worried about the success of the program anymore because everybody else was grabbing onto the things that they were doing. They were able to manage the change at their level because they were supported by me. I was supported by my boss. It was obvious to everybody that that was happening. So when I say joy at work, I do actually mean rainbows and unicorns and sugar plum fairies and all that. But I also mean hardcore analytics underneath it. By every metric, we were driving exactly what you would want to have happen within the business context and achieve the goals that we wanted to achieve, including improving the culture.
Yeah. Well, I'm just curious too. I mean, was it challenging to persuade the executive to move to that kind of format?
Well, we did do a few more incremental
moves. Incremental? Okay.
We got to that one. So we didn't go straight to that. And I didn't tell them everything before it happened. So they experienced some of it in the moment and got the positive reaction back from this team of, it was about 250 or so. And so they were sort of feeling the emotion. And in fact, I think that's probably one of the tactics that I would suggest for folks is to do that. Not necessarily don't hide things and lie about it. But if I had gone and asked permission, or, you know, Roxanne and I had gone and asked permission because she was certainly driving all of this with me, then they probably would have said no. You know, they said, oh, we're going to do this. And it's going to be, no, we're not doing that. Let's just do the safe thing. They would move towards that. But when they experienced it, just as everybody else was experiencing it, they were swept up in it as well. And so it was a much different sort of interaction as a result of that.
Interesting. Well, you know, another question for you, maybe along those lines a little bit, you know, I know in some of your presentations, you've talked about finding influencers to drive change. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I broadly think of this as like two ways to go at it, right? So people know what influencers are. It may be hard to define. You say, who are the people that are influencers, you know, in your group? They could start ticking them off. You know, and a qualitative way to do that would be, if you make a big announcement, who is everybody going to go look at to go see what their reaction to that announcement is going to be? All those people are influencers. Yeah. So, and that's actually not a bad question. But the part that I've tried to dive into is to get taken on as an analytical exercise as well, partly because you could scale it. Whereas that question, that's a tough question to try and scale and get a real answer on. So I've been applying social network analysis to it. So without being like super mathy about it, although I love that stuff. So if you want to talk about the math part, we can. But to give you the overview part of it, the idea is to understand what the connections are between people and then analyze those connections using some of the tools of social network analysis. So some of the easy ones are, how many people are you connected to? How many people would say they're connected to you? So if you're thinking about that from the point of view of your Twitter feed, how many people are you following? How many people follow you? And the more that there is of either one of those, the more you would say somebody is probably an influencer, and you can go measure that. And there are others, how many people act as connectors? So here's a group of people on one side and a group of people on the other side, and they're connected through maybe two or three other people. So those two or three people have influence because messages going from one group to the other have to go through them. They act as a bridge basically between them. So we could, if you get the data about this, you can go and analyze it. So how do you get the data? Well, the data can be all kinds of things. So you can pull emails, not the content, but who is sending emails to whom. So how many emails do I send to which people? How many people are sending emails to me? And you can analyze all that stuff. I've done it through surveys. So if we're putting in a new system, you can ask a question, who are the people you're most likely to go to ask a question about the new system? And you will quickly find who are the gurus that live within the group that people go to try and understand, how do I work my new system or this new policy or this new process? And almost every time we've done that, we're surprised by who pops up, because there are always quiet people that are the magnets for this kind of information. And it's not necessarily easy to find them. And this is a way to reveal who they are. And then once you know that, then try and come up with strategies to engage with them, because they are going to be influencers. So we've gone, found those people and gone to them and said, hey, people think really highly of you. We would like to engage you more on this than we might otherwise, because we think you could have a really big impact. So would you review some of the work that we're doing before we kick it out the door so that we get your feedback on it? Which, you know, people do all the time for this kind of stuff, but they tend to do it in a broad way, or you go to the boss and say, hey, boss, can you give me a few people? And maybe you find those influencers. But what we keep seeing again and again is that we don't find all of them. And so this is a way to use a relatively light analytical technique to be able to go find those folks and engage them in the change. And that's just a way to push out what you're trying to do. And in change management disciplines, if people will talk about the stakeholders and who are the right stakeholders, or you might get an ambassador team together. Well, this is how that fits in. We will find those influencers and help turn them into an ambassador team that can have a big influence on the change.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of those models for, you know, social network analysis. I think the other thing too is that sometimes positionally it can be a little bit different. So the person that has a lot of influence is not a senior level person at all. They're just,
absolutely, because it could be a bunch of things, right? It could be longevity. They've been there a long time and they just know the history of the organization. And so if you're trying to understand this weird, quirky process that we have, well, they might actually know why that exists and what would break if you decided to change that process, because there could be three or four things that are hidden down underneath that's not obvious when you come at it from the top or when you haven't been doing it for a long time. There are people that are influencers because of just who they are, their personality. They're outgoing. They make connections. They're the ones that are welcoming new people in. It's just that's who they are. And they have a great influence on folks as a result of that. And, you know, those influences can be both positive and negative. So trying to understand those as well, you know, is this a upbeat person that's driving the energy or a downbeat person that's bringing everybody down? But we would go after both, because what we found is the grumpy ones, if you can turn them, then that can have an even more or larger impact than any others, because people do look at them and expect them to have a negative attitude. And when they don't, that sends a gigantic signal about what is going on with whatever that change is. So that's sort of a change management ninja move there to see if you can move those people to your side and get them to help you drive the change.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we mentioned this before, you know, change fatigue, but, you know, with a lot of organizations, you know, having experienced, you know, around the world, a tremendous amount of change over the last couple of years. Yeah, how do you continue to, you know, manage that and, you know, are and kind of make sure that, you know, you can continue to put in, you know, processes for change, even knowing that, you know, you're likely your colleagues, staff, folks have just, you know, kind of had it maybe with, you know, with going with through what they've been through over the last couple of years.
All right. So this idea of change fatigue is one that certainly makes sense given all that we've had to take on over the last few years. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of change. We've changed in many ways the very structure of how we do things because we've had to go to this hybrid setup. But I do think that change fatigue is useful to pay attention to, but not useful from the point of view of we should figure out how to do less things so people will be less tired. Instead, I think we got to do the same or maybe even more things, but we have to do them better. So how we go about doing those are really the driver of what sort of fatigue folks are going to end up having. And I think people can do lots of stuff and in series, as long as you're driving all of those changes in a way that actually lifts up the culture, what we would call increases or grows joy at work. And so as we're into this hybrid mode, which is certainly providing a whole bunch of interesting challenges for us, especially around how do we interact and communicate with each other, I think we need to push on our creativity with that. But I would also remind everybody, especially those that have been in large organizations, which I have, two Fortune 200 companies plus the U.S. Navy, we weren't all hanging out together, right? There's so many people that you are geographically spread. And so we weren't hybrid from the point of view that some of us are at home and some of us are in offices. We're mostly all in offices, but we weren't hanging out physically together. So we were doing meetings that were on the telephone, and we did have to connect with each other on email. And we managed to do that quite successfully for several decades, right? Not just me, lots of people. And so we can use that thinking to contemplate how we would go about driving change in the future. So it does matter to be together, but you don't have to be together all the time in order to get stuff done. So can we be more strategic about when we're going to go do that? So it gets back to my all hands example, right? I'm flying 200 people in from all over the country. That's a tremendous amount of money that I'm spending just to physically move them, and a tremendous amount of money that I'm spending to take up that time to have them be part of that meeting or in a series of meetings that will go around it. Are we getting the value out of that? So are we really thinking our way through all the interactions that are happening? Do we have an intention for what we want to get out of that meeting? Are we clear about that? And are we designing everything around it? Or are we being lazy and just getting everybody together because that's what we've always done? And I think there is a decent amount of manager laziness. And I say that with as much love as I could possibly give, because I've been in those jobs and that is super hard to do. But we, as managers, take people and we used to throw them into rooms. Now we throw them into video rooms to go have a meeting without a strong purpose behind it. And it ends up being wasteful. And I think that also ends up being tiring. And so people are tired out from the change, but also tired out from back-to-back Zoom meetings or Teams meetings or other video meetings because we're unable or aren't trying to be as efficient and useful in all those meetings as we possibly can be. And so we're just burning up more time to interact with it. And that time is not uplifting. And we're doing things within that time that you could have just sent an email, or you could have just done something much easier. It could have been a 15-minute phone call instead of a 60-minute video meeting. And we're not thinking through that. Like, maybe audio would have been just fine. We could have done it on the phone. And so if you wanted to be on your phone and take a walk and listen in on the meeting, you could have. But instead, we trapped you to your chair and told you to turn your video camera on, and then executed the super boring meeting, which was 17 PowerPoint slides that could have all actually been written into one single memo. Now, not all the time. I'm sure many of those are very useful, but some of the time we are doing that. And I think that does kind of wear us out with that whole process. And all of that requires way more energy for the people who are the managers to go execute on. But if you think about every manager has a multiplication effect across all the people that they're responsible for, I would say that's worth doing because you are going to get the lift as a result of doing that.
So I think it's a good segue for, you know, a lot of the folks that are listening to this are professional communicators. And, you know, you talked a lot about the how. And so what advice do you have for folks that are, you know, working in that capacity and advice for them in communicating, you know, change, which, you know, I know from, you know, just talking with a lot of our, you know, the IBC members, you know, it's something that it's been a roller coaster over the last couple of years. And I'm sure there's been a lot of learnings, but what's some of the advice that you have for professional communicators?
Yeah. What's interesting for me, so glad I get a chance to talk with you, is my first non-military experience with a profession that I never heard about before was with a communicator. And so someone says, so-and-so is going to come talk with you about communication. I'm like, what is that? What does that even mean? I had no idea what that even meant. And what she did that was so eye-opening for me is that she had a point of view about how to go about communicating to a large group. And I really didn't. You know, I had a, hey, just say stuff to them and it'll all work out. Like, I just didn't have a way to think about it. And she clearly did. And so, and thought about it in this methodological way, right? She had a methodology, a way to go do it. I did not. And so what was useful about working with her is that she was able to lift up what I was trying to do because she provided an expertise that I didn't have. So everybody that's on here has got some level of expertise, that's listening here has got some level of expertise that managers, leaders that you're working with probably don't have. Almost certainly all of them don't have it. So you provide something that is unique, that's special. And first thing I would say is own that, right? Recognize that that's a true statement, that you actually know something that other people don't know how to do. I would think about that thing and how do you bring that to that particular leader or that particular manager, but also recognize, because I've been on this side too, that that leader or manager is probably overloaded in terms of what they can take on. And so thinking as strategically as you can about how do you insert your special knowledge into the stream of things that that person has got to go do. And that's going to be unique in probably every situation so that they're actually able to take it on. So I will give you one of my pet peeves in the change management industry. I'll see if this applies here or not. I hear change management people say all the time, if leaders would only ... then this change effort would be so much easier. And coming from the point of view of having been one of those leader people, I get what you're saying, but I did not have the capacity to take on whatever the other thing was. And what changed for me, and was mostly with Roxanne, who's now my partner in this business, is that she was able to bring what she knew as a change management expert into what I was trying to do as a leader of this organization. And I was able to lead differently as a result of that. So instead of being at a place where it's, you're doing it wrong, you need to listen to me, and here's a whole bunch of things I need you to do, and I'm already flowing over, I just can't take that on. And instead was able to insert that bit by bit. And, you know, maybe this is babying me some, but was patient with me as she's trying to take me through all that. I would imagine that that is very true for many of the folks that are listening to this, that it can be super frustrating to know what the right thing to do is, and then to be blocked by the leader that just can't take it on. And I would tell you, try and have some empathy for them, because they may actually, even though it might not seem like it, be trying as hard as they can to try and make this thing happen, lead whatever the group is, and they just can't take it in. And so if you can come to them with that attitude, hopefully you will find more that were like me, clueless and didn't know what to do, but were able to step in and take on the expertise that you have to offer. And they, you, and everybody that you're going to influence will have a very positive benefit as a result of that.
That's great advice. I did have a question for you, just, you know, because I know you work as a professor as well. And any books that you would recommend for anything recent, or things that, you know, on change management that is sort of like your Bible, or, you know, just kind of the something that everyone should have, not that it needs to be the Bible, but just kind of a standard.
Well, what I would suggest, as just partly because it's an interesting story and an interesting read, is the book's called Joy Inc. And it's written by Richard Sheridan. And it is about his experiences. He is the CEO of a company called Menlo Innovations up in Ann Arbor. And it's about how he set up his company with the idea of driving joy at work. He didn't call it joy at work, but obviously used the word joy. And what he actually did, and what I like about that book, is he's executing what I would call change management techniques without calling them change management techniques. And I'm imagining that some of his communication techniques, the people listening to this would totally recognize, although he probably doesn't use the same terminology that you do. He's not coming from that background, but was very thoughtful about how he wanted to drive his organization and set up the culture. And then as a result of that, all sorts of processes fell out of that I would call unusual. Because he took that point of view first of, I'm going to make this a great, joyful place. How do I institute change, and how do I communicate in a way that helps make that happen? And byproduct of that, which is also important, is, you know, it's a successful company, right? They're making money and interacting well with their clients because the people, in this case, software developers within the company, love the company, love what they're doing, and get to express the full range of all of their talents to be able to deliver for the client.
Interesting. Okay. And any recent articles or anything like that that you would recommend as well? Or,
well, there's a podcast that I really like, because it's a step back into the human psychology about why I think some of this stuff is valuable. So the podcast is called Hidden Brain, and it's a driven by NPR. Shankar Vedantam is the host. He's a former journalist. You might say he's still a journalist, but he's expanded as a result of this. And every one of those episodes has some sort of a lesson in there that it's certainly valuable from the point of view of the things that I do. How do I help people make better decisions? How do I help people then implement those decisions through a change. But I would certainly think applicable to a group of people that are interested in communicating to humans and trying to understand how do people take things on and how do they think about the world. And so I find that every single episode has got some little nugget in there. So I would offer that up to the folks listening here, something to take on.
Yeah, that's great. Last question for you. We asked, I think, everybody. What gets you up in the morning?
Well, I have a very varied life now, as you've mentioned some of those things, right? So sometimes I'm a professor, sometimes I'm a consultant. I work with big giant companies and I work with pretty small companies. And so I love that I get to do all of these different things, but the thread that like runs through all of that stuff is I'm paying attention in all of those cases to these things that I'm really interested in, which is how do groups come together to make a great decision? How do you implement that change? And how do you manage the team better? So those three things with the driver of trying to create a more joyful culture as a result of that. And then underneath all of that stuff is analytics. So at this point in my life, I now get to do all these things that I'm interested in. They all get to be bundled together and I get to do them in multiple different venues, whether that's talking to MBA students or talking to sophomore business students that are taking their first analytics class and they're just petrified of how that's going to go, to working with companies that are trying to solve really important problems. And any one of those or any mix of those are happening for me every single day. So it's great that I get to wake up and I look at my calendar and go, cool, I get to do these things.
It's great. Well, Ed, thanks so much. I have learned a bunch and yeah, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Peter. Glad to get a chance to do it. This was great.
Cool. Well, thanks to Ed. I really enjoyed speaking with him. We will have some more episodes coming up that will feature and preview some of the speakers at World Conference, which will be held and hosted in Toronto in June. And we look forward to seeing many of our IBC members there and folks in the community. So thanks so much for listening.